The next time my frustration with her was even more pointed. I didn't understand that the bold horse of Snowflower's childhood had been broken in spirit. I was stubborn enough to believe I could fix a horse that had gone lame. My life changed forever on the 15th day of the 8th lunar month of the 6th year of Xiang Feng's reign. Mid-autumn festival had arrived. A few days remained before our daughter's footbinding began. This year, Snowflower and her children were to visit us for the holiday. But they were not who came to my threshold. It was Lotus, one of the women who'd lived under our tree in the mountains. She reached into the basket of mooncakes that hung on her arm.
"Our friend has asked me to give you something."
She pulled out a long, slender package wrapped in a fragment of celadon-colored silk I had recently given Snowflower. Lotus handed it to me, wished me good fortune, and swayed down the alley. I knew from the shape what I was holding, but I couldn't fathom why Snowflower hadn't come and had sent the fan instead. I took the bundle upstairs and sat in my chair by the lattice window. I stared at the package for a long time. How did I know to be afraid? Finally, I peeled back one edge, then another, of the green silk until our fan was fully exposed. I picked it up. Then I slowly clicked open one fold after another. Next to the charcoal ink characters we had written the night before we came down from the mountains, I saw a new column of characters. "I have too many troubles," Snowflower had written. "I cannot be what you wish. You won't have to listen to my complaints anymore. Three sworn sisters have promised to love me as I am. Write to me, not to console me as you have been doing, but to remember our happy girl days together." And that was it. I felt like a sword had thrust into my body. Love? Was she really talking about love with sworn sisters in our secret fan? I read the lines again, confused. "Three sworn sisters have promised to love me." But Snowflower and I were Lao Tang. We had pledged to be true and faithful until death parted us. That she seemed to be abandoning our promises in favor of a new relationship with sworn sisters hurt beyond reason. To me, what she had written was 10,000 times worse than if my husband had walked in and announced he'd just taken his first concubine. And it wasn't as though I hadn't been given the opportunity to join a post-marriage sisterhood myself, but I had schemed and plotted to keep Snowflower in my life. Now she was tossing me aside? Just when I thought my devastation could go no deeper, I realized that the three sworn sisters she had written about had to be the ones from her village whom we'd met in the mountains. In my mind, I replayed everything that had happened last winter. Had she been attracted to them, like a husband to new concubines? Were the beds of those women warmer, their bodies firmer, their stories fresher? Did she look at their faces and see no expectations and no responsibilities? This pain was unlike anything I had felt before. Far worse than childbirth, far worse than footbinding. Then something shifted in me. I began to react not as the little girl who had fallen in love with Snowflower, but as Lady Lu, the woman who believed that rules and conventions could provide peace of mind. It was easier for me to begin picking at Snowflower's faults than to feel the emotions raging inside of me. Once I began to focus on her weaknesses, a pattern of deceit, deception, and betrayal began to emerge. I thought about all the times Snowflower had lied to me, about her family, about her married life, even about her beatings. Not only had she not been a faithful Lao Tang, she had not even been a very good friend. A friend would have been honest and forthright. If all this were not enough, I let memories of the recent weeks wash over me. Snowflower had taken advantage of my money and position to gain better clothes, better food, and a better situation for her daughter, while ignoring all my help and suggestions. I felt duped and immensely foolish. And then the strangest thing happened. An image of my mother came to my mind. Just like Snowflower, she had looked out only for her own selfish interests. My first reaction to my mother's lies had been anger, and I never forgave her.
but over time she no longer had an emotional hold over me. To protect my heart, this was what I would have to do with Snowflower. I couldn't let anyone know I was dying from anguish that she no longer loved me. I folded the fan and put it away. Snowflower had asked me to write back. I didn't. A week went by. I did not start my daughter's foot binding on our agreed-upon date. Another week passed. Lotus came to my door again, this time delivering a letter.
Why have you not written? Are you ill? I began my daughter's binding on the 24th day, just as you and I began ours. Did you begin on that date, too? I look out my lattice window to yours. My heart soars out to you, singing happiness for our daughters.
I set one corner of the paper into the flame of the oil lamp. In the coming days, as the weather cooled and I began my daughter's foot binding, more letters arrived. I burned them, too. I was 33 years old. I would be lucky to live another 7 years. I could not endure the sick feeling in my stomach for another minute, let alone a year or more. My torment was great, but I summoned the same discipline that had gotten me through my foot binding, the epidemic, and the winter in the mountains to help me. I began what I called cutting a disease from my heart. Anytime a memory came into my mind, I painted over it with black ink. When memories of Snowflower's love continued to torment me, I constructed a flower tower like the one we had built to ward off Beautiful Moon Spirit. I purged my baskets, trunks, drawers, and shelves of gifts Snowflower had made for me over the years. I sought every letter she had written in our lifetime together. But I had a hard time finding everything. I couldn't find our fan. I couldn't find... Let's just say many things were missing. But what I found, I pasted or placed in the flower tower. Then I composed the letter. You who once knew my heart now know nothing of me. I burn all your words. You who betrayed and abandoned me are gone from my heart forever. Please, please, leave me alone. I folded the paper and slipped it through the tiny lattice window and into the upstairs chamber of the flower tower. Then I set fire to the foundation. But Snowflower was persistent in her haunting. Two people bore the brunt of my suffering. The first, I'm ashamed to admit, was my daughter. The second, I'm sorry to say, was old Madam Wong. My mother love was very strong, and when I bound Jade's feet, you will never know just how careful I was, remembering not only what had happened to Third Sister, but also all the lessons my mother-in-law had instilled in me about how to do this job properly, with the least chance of infection, deformity, or death. But I also transferred the pain I felt about Snowflower out of my body and into my daughter's feet. Weren't my lily feet the source of all my pains and gains? I took my feelings and harnessed them, driving my daughter back and forth across the floor of our upstairs room, chastising her, no, crying bitterly at her, with what my mother had drilled into me. A true lady lets no ugliness into her life. Only through pain will you have beauty. Only through suffering will you find peace. I wrap, I bind, but you will have the reward. I hope that through my actions I might reap a little of that reward and find the peace my mother had promised. My daughter's feet came out nearly as small as my own. But before I knew the final outcome of that, Madam Wong paid me a call in the fifth month of the new lunar year.
Lady Lu, it's been too long, she said as she plopped down in a chair.
She reached into her sleeve and pulled out a fan.
I brought this for your daughter.
I reached out my hand. Inside my head, I had an army of brushes with black ink, obliterating the thoughts and memories that kept popping up. In one swift movement, I opened the fan.
I understand there is a girl of good character and women's learning in your home. These were the first characters Snowflower had written to me so many years ago. I looked up and saw Madam Wong's gaze upon me, watching for my reaction, but I kept my features as placid as the surface of a pond on a still night. Our two families plant gardens. two flowers bloom. They are ready to meet. You and I are of the same year. Shall we not be old sames? Together we will soar above the clouds. I heard Snowflower's voice in every carefully drawn character. I snapped the fan shut and held it out to Madame Wang. She did not take it. I think, Madame Wang, there has been a mistake. The eight characters of these two girls do not match. They were born on different days in different months. More importantly, their feet did not match. And family circumstances do not match. All of this is common knowledge. Madame Wang's eyes narrowed.
You think I don't know the truth of these things? She snorted. Let me tell you what I know. You have severed your bond with no explanation. A woman, your Lao Tang, weeps in confusion.
Confusion? Do you know what she did?
Speak to her,
Madame Wang went on.
Don't disrupt a plan that was agreed upon by two loving mothers. Two girls have a bright future together. They can be as happy as their mothers.
You do not know of what you speak. On the day your niece and I signed our contract, you said, no concubines allowed. Do you remember that old woman? Now go ask your niece what she has done. I tossed the fan into the matchmaker's lap and turned my face away.
I will relay your message,
she said at last, her voice filled with kindness and a deep understanding that agitated me.
But know this. You are a rare person. I saw that long ago. Everyone in our county envies your good luck. Everyone wishes you longevity and prosperity. But I see you breaking two hearts. It is so sad. I remember the little girl you were. You had nothing but a pretty pair of feet. Now you have abundance in your life, Lady Lu. An abundance of malice, ingratitude, and forgetfulness.
A year went by. The day of Snowflower's cousins sitting and singing in the upstairs chamber next door approached. Snowflower and I had planned to go to the celebration together. I didn't know if she would still come. The 10th day of the 10th month arrived. A good and propitious date for the neighbor girl to begin her wedding activities. I walked next door and went to the upstairs chamber. I spotted Madame Wang, and next to her, Snowflower, dressed in one of the outfits I had given her. I took a seat across the room from Snowflower and her aunt. The celebration had all of the usual singing, complaints, stories, and jokes. Then the mother of the bride asked Snowflower to tell us of her life since leaving Tangku. Today, I will sing a letter of vituperation, Snowflower announced. This was not at all what I had anticipated. How could Snowflower possibly want to make a public grievance against me when I was the one who had been wronged? Then Snowflower began to sing. As a girl, I was prized as a daughter, but everyone here knows how hard my life has been. The bride's sworn sisters wept in sympathy as they were supposed to. Their mothers listened attentively. I had but one happiness in my life, my Lao Tang, Snowflower went on. In our contract we wrote there would never be a harsh word between us, and for 27 years this was so. But when I told her of my sadness, she had no patience, believing I could change my destiny. I watched the women in the room cry for her. I was beyond stunned. Why have you turned away from me? She sang out, her voice high and beautiful. You and I are Lao Tang. And why have you hurt my daughter? Do not make a third generation of women suffer. At this last bit, the air in the room changed as the others took in this final injustice. Life was hard enough for girls without my making it harder for someone far weaker than myself. I drew myself up. I was Lady Lu, the woman with the greatest respect in the county, and I should have risen above this. Instead, I addressed Snowflower's last and most unfair accusation first. I looked from woman to woman as I sang. Our two girls cannot be Lao Tang. They are not the same in any way. Your old neighbor wants something for her daughter, but I won't break the taboo. In saying no, I have done what any mother would do.
Then, all the women in this room know hardship. As girls, we are raised as useless branches. We marry out into villages we do not know, into families we do not know, to men we do not know. We work endlessly. We bear children. Sometimes they die, sometimes we die. When our husbands tire of us, they take in concubines. We have all faced adversity. None of this is so special. But this woman seeks special attention for her woes.
I turned to Snowflower. Tears stung my eyes as I sang to her, and I regretted the words as soon as they left my mouth.
You and I were matched as a pair of mandarin ducks. I always remain true, but you've shunned me to embrace sworn sisters. A girl sends a fan to one girl, not riding new ones to many. A good horse does not have two saddles. A good woman is not unfaithful to her Lao Tong. Perhaps your perfidy is why your husband, your mother-in-law, your children, and yes, the betrayed old same before you do not cherish you as they might. If my husband came home today with a concubine, I would be thrown from my bed, neglected, dismissed from his attentions. I, as all the women here, would have to accept it.
But from you? My throat closed in on itself, and the tears I'd been holding back escaped from my eyes. For a moment, I thought I couldn't go on. We might expect this loss of affection from our husbands. They have a right, and we are only women. But to endure this from another woman, who by her very sex has experienced much cruelty just by living, is merciless. My doorstep is clean, I declared, then turned to Snowflower. But what about yours?
At that moment, an untapped spring of anger came bubbling to the surface, and the words I used came from such a dark and bitter place that I felt as though I'd been sliced open with a knife. I knew everything about Snowflower, and I proceeded to use it against her under the guise of social correctness and the strength of my being Lady Lu. I held nothing back because I had lost all control. Unbidden, a long-ago memory came to me of my younger sister's leg flailing and her loose bindings twirling around her. With each invective I threw out, I felt as though my bindings had come loose and I was finally free to say what I really thought. It took me many years to realize that the bindings weren't flying through the air and slapping at my Lao Tong. Rather, they were whirling tighter and tighter around me, trying to squeeze away the deep heart love I'd longed for my entire life. This woman who was your neighbor took with her a dowry that was made from her mother's dowry, so that when that poor woman went out onto the street, she had no quilts or clothes to keep her warm, I proclaimed. This woman who was your neighbor does not keep a clean house. Her husband carries on a polluted business. This woman lied about her circumstances as a girl in her daughter days, lied as a young woman in her hairpinning days, and continues to lie as a wife and mother in her rice and salt days. She has lied not only to all of you, but to her Lao Tong as well. When we were in the mountains running from the rebels, I rocked forward and the others leaned toward me. She did bed business with her husband rather than be with me, her Lao Tong. She says she must have done bad deeds in a former life, but I, as Lady Lu, tell you that her bad deeds in this life made her fate. Snowflower sat across from me, tears running down her cheeks. But I was so desolate and confused that I could show only my anger. We wrote a contract as girls, I concluded. You made a promise, which you broke. Snowflower took a deep, quivering breath.
You once asked that I always tell you the truth, but when I tell it to you, you don't like what you hear. I have found women in my village who do not look down on me. They do not criticize me. Every word she spoke reinforced everything I had suspected. They do not humiliate me in front of others, Snowflower went on. I have embroidered with them, and we console one another when we are troubled. They do not pity me. They visit me when I have not been well. I am lonely and alone. I need women to comfort me every day, not just at the times of your choosing. I need women who can hear me as I am, and not how they remember me or wish me to be. I feel like a bird flying alone. I cannot find my mate. Her soft words and gentle excuses were just what I was afraid of.
I closed my eyes, trying to block my feelings.
To protect myself, I had to hold on to this grievance as I had with my mother. When I opened my eyes, Snowflower had lifted herself to her feet and was delicately swaying towards the stairs. When Madame Wong did not follow her, I felt a pang of sympathy. Even her own aunt, the only one among us who made a living and survived on her wits, would not offer solace. When I look back on that day, I know that I failed terribly in my duties and obligations as a woman. What she had done was unforgivable, but what I said was despicable. Ironically, the very things that embarrassed me and that I later felt much regret over completed my passage to becoming Lady Lu. My neighbors had seen me be brave when my husband was away in Guilin. They knew how I'd cared for my mother-in-law during the epidemic and survived the winter in the mountains, and generally acquitted myself well as the wife of the head man. But on that day, I truly earned the respect that came with being Lady Lu, by doing what all women are supposed to do for their country but can rarely accomplish. A woman must set an example of decorum and right thinking in the inside realm. If she is successful, these things will travel from her door to the next, making not only women and children behave properly, but inspiring our men to make the outside realm as safe and settled as possible, so the emperor can look out from his throne and see peace. I did all that in the most public way possible, by showing my neighbors that Snowflower was a low and base woman who should not be a part of our lives. I had succeeded, even as I destroyed my Lao Tong. My song of vituperation became known. It was recorded on handkerchiefs and fans. It was taught to girls as a didactic lesson and sung during the month of wedding festivities to warn brides of life's pitfalls. In this way, Snowflower's disgrace spread throughout the county. As for me, all that had happened crippled me. What was the point of being Lady Lu if I didn't have love in my life? 8 years passed. During that time, Emperor Shangfeng died. Emperor Tang Ji assumed power, and the Taiping Rebellion ended somewhere in a distant province. My first son married in and his wife got pregnant, fell into our home and had a son, the first of many precious grandsons. My son also passed his exams to become a Shangyuan district scholar. He did not have much time for his wife, but I think she found comfort in our upstairs chamber. I liked her very much. My daughter, a girl of 16, well into her hairpinning days, was betrothed to the son of a rice merchant in faraway Guilin. I might never see Jade again, but this alliance would further protect our ties to the salt business. The Lu family was wealthy, well-respected, and without bad fortune. I was 42 years old, and I had done my very best to forget about Snowflower. On a day late in fall in the fourth year of Emperor Tang Ji's reign, Yonggong came into the upstairs room and whispered in my ear that someone wanted to see me. I asked her to show the guest upstairs, but Yonggong shook her head no. Without a word to the others, I went downstairs. As I entered the main room, a young girl in worn clothes dropped to her knees and put her forehead to the floor.
"Lady Lu, only you can help me," the girl implored, as she shuffled her crumpled form toward me until her forehead rested on my lily feet.
The girl began to weep. I asked her to rise, and she lifted her head and looked up into my face. I would have recognized her anywhere. Snowflower's daughter looked exactly like her mother at that age.
"My mother is very sick. She will not last the winter. We can do nothing for her now except settle her fretful mind. Please come to her. She calls out to you."
I could never forgive Snowflower for all the sadness she had caused me, but for my own position in the county, I had to show my face as a gracious lady. I told Spring Moon to go home and promised that I would arrive there shortly. Then I arrange for a palanquin to take me to Jin Qian. The palanquin set me down before Snowflower's threshold. The place had not changed. The butcher's form loomed in the dark doorway, and then he was before me, older, stringier.
"I cannot bear to see her suffer," were the first words he spoke to me after 8 years. He roughly wiped the dampness at his eyes with the back of his hand. "I was cruel to her, Lady Lu. I see that now."
Then he brushed past me, adding,
"She is better off in the company of women."
I watched him stalk towards the fields, the one place where a man can be alone with his emotions. It is hard for me to think about this even after all these years. I thought I had erased Snowflower from my memory and cut her from my heart. I had truly believed I would never forgive her for loving Sworn Sisters more than me. But the moment I saw Snowflower on her bed, all those thoughts and emotions fell away. Time, life, had brutalized her. I stood there, an older woman, true, but my skin was still smooth from creams. In the bed across the room lay Snowflower, an aged crone dressed in rags. And yes, the other women were there. Lotus, Willow, and Plum Blossom. As I suspected all those years ago, Snowflower's sworn sisters were the women who'd live with us under the tree in the mountains. We did not exchange greetings. As I approached the bed, Spring Moon rose and stepped aside. Snowflower's eyes were closed and her skin was deathly pale. I took Snowflower's cold hand in my own. My Lao Tong's eyes blinked open.
"I felt your touch. I knew it was you."
Her voice was weak, but when she spoke, I saw and heard the little girl who invited me to become her Lao Tong all those years ago. "I heard you call for me," I lied. "I came as fast as I could."
"I was waiting."
Her face contorted in anguish. Her other hand clutched her stomach and she pulled up her legs reflexively. Through her agony, she spoke.
"I'm sorry for everything. But you should know, I never wavered in my love for you."
As I accepted her apology, another spasm hit, this one worse than the first. I sat with her until the sun went down. By that time, the other women had left, and Spring Moon had gone downstairs to make dinner. Alone with Snowflower, I pulled back her quilt. Her disease had eaten the flesh around her bones and fed it to a tumor that had grown to the size of a baby inside her belly. Even now, I can't explain my emotions. I had been hurt and angry for so long. I thought I would never forgive Snowflower, but instead of dwelling on that, my mind tumbled with the realization that my Lao Tong's womb had betrayed her again, and that the tumor inside her must have been growing for many years. I had a duty to care. No, that's not it. The whole time I was hurt, it was because I still love Snowflower. She was the only one ever who saw my weaknesses and loved me in spite of them. And I had loved her even when I hated her most. I tucked the quilt back around her and went downstairs. The butcher slouched at the table. Snowflower's son, a grown man now, stood next to his sister. They looked at me with expressions that came directly from their mother, proud, enduring, long-suffering, beseeching. "I'm going home now," I announced. Snowflower's son's face crumpled in disappointment, but I held up my hand placatingly. "I will be back tomorrow. Please arrange a place for me to sleep. I will not leave this place until..." I couldn't go on. I thought that once I settled in, we would win this battle. But 2 weeks were all we had. 2 weeks out of what would turn out to be my 80 years to show Snowflower all the love I felt for her. Not once did I leave that room. At night, after the others left, I moved from the cot the family had prepared for me and into the bed next to Snowflower. I wrapped my arms around her, trying to bring warmth to her shriveled form. Each morning I woke to find her hand upon my cheek, her hollowed eyes staring at me. Pain exists at many levels. The physical agony that Snowflower endured. The sorrow at seeing her suffer and believing that I couldn't bear another moment. the torturous regret I felt for the things I had said to her 8 years ago. I'd been wrong. And during those long days, I saw the solace that the other women brought to Snowflower. They had not come to her just at this final moment as I had. They had watched over her for many years. Their generosity in the form of little bags of rice, cut vegetables, and gathered firewood had kept her alive. Now they came every day, neglecting their duties at home. They did not crowd in on our special relationship. Instead, they hovered like benign spirits, praying, continuing to light fires to scare away ghosts, eager for Snowflower, but always leaving us to ourselves. I must have slept, but I don't remember it. Snowflower deteriorated. All that was left was to ease her way to the afterworld as best we could. Yong Gong saw all of this when she came to see me each morning, bringing fresh eggs, clean clothes, and messages from my husband. She had been obedient and loyal to me for many years, but at this time I discovered that she had once broken faith with me in a way for which I will be forever grateful. 3 days before Snowflower died, Yong Gong arrived for one of her early morning visits, knelt before me, and laid a basket at my feet. "I saw you, lady, many years ago," she said, her voice cracking in fear. "I knew you couldn't mean what you were doing." I didn't know what she was talking about. Then she pulled the cloth from the top of the basket, reached in, and took out letters, handkerchiefs, embroideries, and Snowflower's and my secret fan. These were things I'd looked for when I was burning our past, but this servant had risked being thrown into the streets to save them during those days of cutting a disease from my heart, and then kept them protected all these years. Seeing this, Spring Moon and the Sworn Sisters scurried around the room to find secret hiding places. Soon I had before me all the letters I had ever written Snowflower, and everything I had ever made for her. In the end, everything, except what I had once destroyed, was there. For the last days of Snowflower's life, I took us on a journey through our lives together, reading our letters and the messages we'd embroider to each other. At night, in bed together under the lattice window, the moonlight bathing us, we were transported back to our hairpinning days. I wrote new shoe characters on her palm. The bed is lit by moonlight. During the last conversation we had, she asked, "Could you do one thing for me?" "Anything. Please be an aunt to my children." I promised that I would. In the final hours, I read her our contract, reminding her how we had gone to the Temple of Gu Po and bought the red paper, sat down together, and composed the words. I read again the happy parts from our fan. I told her how much I loved her, and said I hoped she would be waiting for me in the afterworld. I talked her all the way to the edge of the sky, not wanting her to go, yet yearning to release her into the clouds. Snowflower's skin went from ghostly white to golden. A lifetime of worries melted from her face. The Sworn Sisters, Spring Moon, Madam Wong, and I listened to Snowflower's breathing. An inhale, an exhale, then nothing. Seconds passed, then an inhale, an exhale, then nothing. The whole time I kept my hand on Snowflower's cheek, as she had done for me throughout our entire lives together, letting her know that her Lao tongue was there, until that final inhale, exhale, and then truly nothing. Snowflower was carried down to the main room. I washed her and dressed her in her eternity clothes, all of them ragged and faded, but in patterns I remembered from our childhood. 3 days later, the butcher, his son, and the husbands and sons of the Sworn Sisters carried the coffin to the gravesite. They walked very fast, as if they were flying across the ground. I took almost all of Snowflower's new shoe writing, including much of what I had sent her, and burned it so she would have our words in the afterworld. We returned to the butcher's house. Spring Moon made tea, while the three Sworn Sisters and I went upstairs to clean away all signs of death. It was through them that I learned of my greatest shame. They told me that Snowflower was not their sworn sister. But the fan, I cried out in frustration. She wrote that she was joining you.
No, Lotus corrected. She wrote that she didn't want you to worry about her anymore, that she had friends here to console her.
They asked if they could see the words for themselves. Snowflower, I learned, had taught these women how to read Nyushu. Now they crowded over the fan.
Look, Lotus said, pointing to the characters. There is nothing here about her becoming our sworn sister.
I have too many troubles, Snowflower had written. I cannot be what you wish. You won't have to listen to my complaints anymore. Three sworn sisters have promised to love me as I am.
You see, Lady Lu, Lotus said to me from across the room. Snowflower wanted us to listen to her, but she didn't love us, she loved you. She wanted that love returned, unburdened by your pity and your impatience.
That I had been shallow, stubborn, and selfish did not alter the gravity and stupidity of what I had done. I had made the greatest mistake for a woman literate in Yushu. I had not considered texture, context, and shades of meaning. More than that, my belief in my own self-importance had made me forget what I had learned on the first day I'd met Snowflower. She was always more subtle and sophisticated in her words than this mere second daughter of a common farmer. For 8 years, Snowflower had suffered because of my blindness and ignorance. For the rest of my life, which has been nearly as many years as Snowflower was when she died, I have lived with the regret. But they were not done with me.
She tried to please you in every way, Lotus said, even by doing bed business with her husband too soon after giving birth.
That's not true. Every time she lost a baby, you offered no more sympathy than her husband or mother-in-law,
Willow went on.
You always said that her only worth was from giving birth to sons, and she believed you. You told her to try again, and she obeyed.
You demanded that she follow your advice on this and many other things, Lotus picked up. Then when she did, you criticized her.
You're changing my meaning.
Are we?
Willow asked.
She talked about you all the time. She never said a bad word against you, but we heard the truth of what happened.
Do you remember when we were in the mountains and she lost the baby?
Lotus asked, in a tone that made me dread what was coming.
Of course I remember. She was already sick.
That's not possible, the butcher. Maybe her husband brought it on that day,
Willow admitted.
But the blood that burst from her body was black, stagnant, dying, and none of us saw a baby in that mess.
The tumor had to have been growing for a very long time. Other things from back then fell into place. Snowflower's loss of appetite, her skin going so pale, and her loss of energy at the very moment when I was nagging her to eat better, pinch her cheeks, and do all of her expected chores to bring harmony to her husband's home. And then I remember that just 2 weeks back when I'd first arrived in this house, she'd apologized. I hadn't done the same, not even when she was in her worst pain, not even when her death was imminent, not even when I was smugly telling myself I still loved her. Her heart had always been pure, but mine had been as shriveled, hard, and dry as an old walnut. I sometimes think about those sworn sisters, all dead now, of course. They had to be careful in what they said to me because I was Lady Lu, but they were not going to let me walk away from that house without knowing the truth. I went home and retired to my upstairs chamber with a fan and a few saved letters. I ground ink until it was as black as the night sky. I opened the fan, dipped my brush into the ink, and made what I thought would be my final entry. You who always knew my heart now fly above the clouds in the warmth of the sun. I hope one day we will soar together. I would have many years to consider those lines and do what I could to change all the harm I had caused to the person I loved most in the world. Sitting quietly. After Snowflower died, I still had half of my life ahead of me. My rice and salt days were not over, but in my heart I began my years of sitting quietly. For most women, this begins with their husband's death. For me, it began with Snowflower's death, but things kept me from being completely still or quiet. My husband and family needed me to be a wife and mother. My community needed me to be Lady Lou. And then there were Snowflower's children, whom I needed, so that I could make amends to my Lao Tong. But it's hard to be truly generous and behave in a forthright manner when you don't know how. The first thing I did in the months immediately following Snowflower's death was to take her place in all her daughter's wedding traditions and ceremonies. Spring Moon seemed resigned to the prospect of marriage, sad to be leaving home, uncertain, having seen the way her father treated her mother, about what lay in store for her. I told myself these were the kinds of things all girls worry about. But on her wedding night, after her new husband fell asleep, Spring Moon committed suicide by throwing herself in the village well.
"That girl not only polluted her new family, but the entire village's drinking water," gossips whispered. "She was just like her mother. Remember that letter of vituperation?"
That I had composed the letter that had ruined Snowflower's reputation raked across my conscience, so I hushed this talk whenever I heard it. Through my words, I became known as someone who was forgiving and charitable to the unclean. But I knew that in my first attempt to make things right with Snowflower, I had failed miserably. The day I wrote that girl's death onto the fan was one of the worst of my life. I next focused my efforts on Snowflower's son. I met his wife, who still lived with her natal family. This time a good choice had been made. The girl became pregnant, but the thought that she would be falling into the butcher's house pained me. Although it is not my way to interfere with the outer realm of men, I prevailed upon my husband, who now had fields that stretched all the way to Jinqian, to find something for this young man to do besides slaughter pigs. He hired Snowflower's son to collect rents from the farmers and gave him a house with its own kitchen garden. Eventually, the butcher retired, moved in with his son, and began doting on his grandson, who brought big joy to that home. The young man and his family were happy, but I knew that I still had not done enough to earn my way back to Snowflower. At age 50, when my monthly bleeding stopped, my life changed again. I experienced a shift from waiting on others to having others wait on me, though I certainly watched what they did and corrected them for anything not done to my satisfaction. But as I said in my heart, I was already sitting quietly. My relationship with my husband turned into one of great companionship. He often came to the women's chamber to drink tea and talk with me. We were more content together at this time than perhaps at any other in our entire lives. We had planted a garden, and it bloomed around us in so many ways. All of our sons married in. All of their wives proved to be fertile. Our home was merry with the sounds of grandchildren. We loved them, but there was one child not of my blood who interested me most of all. I wanted her near me. In a little house in Jinqian, the rent collector's wife had given birth to a girl. I wanted that child, Snowflower's granddaughter, to become my eldest grandson's wife. My husband, after 32 years of marriage, during which I had never caused him to be embarrassed or ashamed of me, was generous enough to grant me this request. I sent for Madame Wang just as the girl's feet were about to be bound. The old woman was escorted into the main room by two big-footed girls, which told me that she had put away enough money to live well. Still, the years had not been kind to Madame Wang. Her face had wizened. She had very little hair. Her back hunched. She was so frail and deformed she could barely walk on her lily feet. I knew then that I didn't want to live so long. Yet here I am. I offered tea and sweetmeats. We made small talk, then I came to the point. "I'm looking for a good match for my grandson."
"Shouldn't I be speaking to the boy's father?"
Madame Wang asked. "He is away and requested that I negotiate on his behalf. I hear there is a good prospect in Jinqian. She is the daughter of the rent collector. I want to marry in a girl who has the most perfect feet in the county."
"This child has not begun that process. There are no guarantees."
"But you have seen these feet, am I correct, Madame Wang? You are a good judge. What do you think the result will be?"
"The child's mother may not know how to do a good job."
"Then I will see to it myself."
You can't bring the girl into this house if you intend a marriage,
Madam Wong said.
It would be improper for your grandson to see his future wife.
She had not changed, but then neither had I. You are right, madam. I will visit the girl's home.
That is hardly appropriate.
I will be visiting often. I have many things to teach her. I watched Madam Wong mull that over. Then I leaned forward and covered the old woman's hand with my own. I believe, Auntie, that the girl's grandmother would have approved. Tears welled in the matchmaker's eyes. This girl will need to learn the womanly arts, I continued hurriedly. She will need to travel. I think you would agree that she should visit the Temple of Gu Po every year. They tell me there once was a man who made a special tarot treat. I hear his grandson continues the legacy.
I persisted in the negotiation, and Snowflower's granddaughter came under my protection. I personally bound her feet, and they came to be perfect golden lilies, identical in size to my own. During the long months that Peony's bones set, I visited her nearly every day. I talked to the girl, weaving stories about her grandmother and her Lao Tang, about writing and singing, about friendship and hardship.
I have not written much about my husband in these pages. All of that is in my official autobiography. But I will say this. He gave me reasons to continue day after day. I had to make sure his meals were provided. I had to think of clever things to amuse him. After he died, I no longer cared to be an exemplar of womanhood in the county. Days drifted into weeks. I forgot about time. Years folded into decades. The problem with living so long is that you see too many people pass before you. I outlive nearly everyone. My parents, my aunt and uncle, my siblings, Madam Wong, my husband, my daughter, two of my sons, all of my daughters-in-law, even Yonggong. My eldest son became a Jinshi scholar. As a court official, my son is away most of the time, but he has secured the Liu family's position for generations to come. He is filial, and has even bought a coffin, big and lacquered, for me to rest in after I die. Peony is now 37, 6 years older than I was when I became Lady Liu. As the wife of my eldest grandson, she will become the new Lady Liu when I die. She has two sons, three daughters, and may yet have more children. Her eldest son married in a girl from another village. She recently gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl. In their faces I see Snowflower, but I also see myself. As girls, we are told that we are useless branches, because we will not carry on our natal family names, but only the names of the families we marry out to, if we are lucky enough to bear sons. All of this is true, and yet these days my contentment comes from knowing that Snowflowers and my blood will soon rule the House of Liu. Years ago, when I was in Jinqian teaching Peony and her sworn sisters the stroke that make up our secret code, many women asked if I would copy down their autobiographies. I could not say no. Of course, I charged them a fee. I was Lady Liu, and they needed to respect my position. But it went beyond that. I wanted them to place a value on their lives, which for the most part were dismal. They suffered the heartache of separation from their parents, the loss of their children, and the indignities of having the lowest position in their in-laws' homes, and far too many of them had husbands who beat them. I know a lot about women and their suffering, but I still know almost nothing about men. If a man does not value his wife upon marriage, why would he treasure her after? If he sees his wife as no better than a chicken who can provide an endless supply of eggs or a water buffalo who can bear an endless amount of weight upon its shoulders, why would he value her any more than those animals? He might appreciate her even less, since she is not as brave, strong, tolerant, or able to scavenge on her own. Having heard so many stories, I thought of my own. For 40 years, the past only aroused regret in me. Only one person ever truly mattered to me.
but I was worse to her than the worst husband. After Snowflower asked me to be an aunt to her children, she said, and these were the last words she ever spoke to me, "Though I was not as good as you, I believe that heavenly spirits joined us. We will be together forever." So many times I've thought back on that. Was she speaking the truth? What if the afterworld has no sympathy? But if the dead continue to have the needs and desires of the living, then I'm reaching out to Snowflower and the others who witnessed it all. Please hear my words. Please forgive me.
Lisa C. talks about the writing of Snowflower and the Secret Fan.
One day in the 1960s, an old woman fainted in a rural Chinese train station. When police searched her belongings in an effort to identify her, they came across papers with what looked to be a secret code written on them. This being the height of the Cultural Revolution, the woman was arrested and detained on suspicion of being a spy. The scholars who came to decipher the code realized almost at once that this was not something related to international intrigue. Rather, it was a written language used solely by women, and it had been kept a secret from men for 1,000 years. Those scholars were promptly sent to labor camp. That secret language, as you now know, was called Nushu, and as soon as I heard about it, I became intrigued. A good part of my interest stemmed from how I was raised. I'm part Chinese and grew up spending a lot of time with my grandparents, aunts, and uncles in Los Angeles, Chinatown. I've often said I may not look Chinese, but I'm Chinese in my heart. I come from a pioneer family. My great-great-grandfather came to work on the Transcontinental Railroad, and my great-grandfather was the patriarch of Los Angeles, Chinatown. We have tenaciously held on to our customs and beliefs, even though we've become better educated, lost our fluency in the language, and, in my case, lost most of the physical characteristics. But I'm only a couple of generations removed from my peasant roots. My great-great-grandmother carried people on her back from village to village to earn money to support her children. Sorrow from losing a child or experiencing some other tragedy was a luxury she and her immigrant descendants couldn't afford. Later, when I began writing Snowflower in the Secret Fan, I was able to show that kind of stoicism and acceptance in the characters of Snowflower, Lily, and the other women who populate the novel. But I also called upon other beliefs that had been handed down in my family. I, like all my female cousins, grew up hearing, "When a girl, obey your father. When a wife, obey your husband. When a widow, obey your son." Of course we rebelled, but we also absorbed more of that aphorism than perhaps we'd like to admit. As I did my research, I discovered that few Nushu documents, whether letters, stories, weavings, or embroideries, have survived, since most were burned at grave sites for metaphysical and practical reasons. In the 1930s, Japanese soldiers destroyed many pieces that had been kept as family heirlooms. During the Cultural Revolution, the zealous Red Guard burned even more texts, then banned the local women from attending religious festivals or going to gatherings where Nushu might be written, read, sung, or exchanged as gifts. In the following years, the Public Security Bureau's scrutiny further diminished interest in learning or preserving the language. During the last half of the 20th century, Nushu nearly became extinct as the primary reasons that women used it disappeared. In the fall of 2002, I went to China to visit Yang Wanyi, who was then aged 96 and the oldest living Nushu writer. On the surface, we couldn't have been more different, but I felt instantly close to her. She reminded me very much of my grandmother. Yang Wanyi's hair was wrapped in a headdress, her back was hunched, her hands and fingers were crooked and knobby, her eyes were watery, her skin was rice paper thin, and when she scratched her cheek, her skin tore and bled. She wore a child's pair of kung fu slippers with tissue stuffed into the toes to fill the empty space. Like Lily at the end of Snowflower, she was too old and too tired to shoo away the flies that came to rest on her. But she was completely alert. She talked about her childhood, her foot binding, her marriage, and her 7 sworn sisters. Many of the lines that are found in the novel come directly from Yang Wangyi's life. "Marrying a daughter is like throwing out a cup of water," people had told her when she got into her flower-sitting chair. Some of the most special moments that day were when she sang her Nushu wedding songs. "Why do I not cry when I get married?" she chanted in a quavering voice. "Because my life is not so happy. I want to get married, have children, and have a happy life." She remembered as well a woman who sang to her, "I'm already 32. I live a miserable life. I wish I could get married and have a happy life." As hard as their lives were, Yang Wangyi explained, it was better to get married than not, for marriage was the only way to true happiness and fulfillment, giving birth to a son. I was still in China when I wrote the opening pages for Snowflower. In many ways, Lily's voice and her view of life were easy. She reminded me of my grandmother, great-aunt, and other female relatives, Chinese or not, at the end of their lives. To a person, they had felt tremendous regret that they hadn't been better wives, mothers, or friends. But they each also had at least one episode in their lives that gnawed at them, and they hoped fruitlessly to somehow make amends. Sitting in my hotel room, I felt as though those women, especially my grandmother, were looking over my shoulder, encouraging me to tell the truth of their lives. I thought that through the character of Lily, maybe I could make amends for all of them. I would say that the entire novel flowed from that emotional place. My only real struggle was how I was going to deal with the subject of foot binding. Although anti-foot binding activities began in the late 19th century, the practice lingered in rural areas well into the 20th century. Only in 1951, when Mao Zedong's armies liberated Jianyang County, did the practice fully end in the Nushu region. Many misconceptions and preconceptions still surround foot binding. It's easy to equate it with female genital mutilation in Africa, the tradition of shrouding women in burqas in the Middle East, or even the strange, peculiar, often extreme cosmetic surgery treatments that so many American women seek. But I didn't want to put my contemporary Western values on the practice. Rather, I wanted to write about foot binding from the perspective of the women and the girls who had grown up with it. For me, this brought up a lot of questions. How does a culture decide what's beautiful? How does our worth as women change according to that sense of beauty? How can a mother put her daughter through such agony? And what would it mean to have achieved the socially accepted and acknowledged beauty of 3-inch feet, yet be hobbled or possibly crippled in the process? Between my own family background, research, and imagination, the writing came easily. Then, when I was about halfway through the novel, I had an accident and got a very bad concussion. For the first month or so, I stayed in bed. Like the Nushu women, I couldn't read or write. Unlike them, I had 2 windows to look out of. For another 2 months, I wasn't allowed to drive. In a strange way, I felt as though my feet had been bound, since I was confined to my home and cut off from the rest of the world. Like many people who've had a sudden medical problem, I was surprised at what happened around me. Friends I thought would be supportive weren't, while others brought food and treats, drove me to doctor's appointments, and in every way acted as sworn sisters. My confinement and isolation, and the kindness and generosity of the women who cared for me, gave me a visceral experience of the Nushu women and their world. But I hope you didn't have to have a concussion to connect to Lily and Snowflower. Snowflower and the Secret Fan is a story about friendship and what it means to be a woman. Yes, our lives are completely different from those lived by the Nushu writers, but I think inside we're the same. We want people to hear our thoughts, appreciate our creativity, and feel empathy for our emotions. As daughters, we have all experienced complicated and sometimes thorny relationships with our mothers. As mothers, we have all felt deep terror when one of our children gets sick. As women, we have all at one time or another wondered about the true and everlasting mystery of the men in our lives. These are universals, as is the fear women feel during times of political upheavals that occur in what could still be called the outside world of men, whether during the Taiping Rebellion so many years ago, or today for women in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Sudan, or even right here in this country in the post-9/11 era. On the surface, we are independent, free, and mobile. But at our cores, we still long for love, friendship, happiness, tranquility, and most of all, to be heard.
This is Jody Long. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Snowflower and the Secret Fan by Lisa C. This program was produced and directed by Lauren Krenzel. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Abridgment by Lynn Lauber. Text copyright 2005 by Lisa C. Production copyright 2005, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.